And back, sharing the burden, live here, live recovery. And although Peter and Jay and myself are not in necessarily in any kind of recovery from anything going on at the moment, I believe a recovery lifestyle is the lifestyle everybody needs to find, you know, and even if it's just recovering from, you know, who they are or who they think other people have made them and all these different things in life. But without that recovery lifestyle, I think we miss so much. You know, we don't forgive properly. We don't dig out to the roots of those we might have harmed. And we really don't get back to things that put us in a position, I think, at some point to kind of accept our powerlessness, you know, which is the beginning of this program. Yet it's the end of it, too, because it's the one thing that presides throughout the whole program, throughout the whole year and throughout life, really, is that living this way is not something that should end, because when it ends, the results you get will end, too. And that's the other thing, you know, when we talk of one of our slogans says, if nothing changes, nothing changes. Well, if I feed this entity, if I feed Scott Duncan garbage food, if I feed him garbage movies, I feed him garbage literature, well, that guy's obviously going to produce garbage, you know. Even if he did a lot of good stuff in the past, the more garbage he puts in there, the more one will outweigh the other, until at some point it'll be kind of garbage ruling, and everything that comes out of the guy, me, will be garbage. So, you know, garbage in, garbage out, like the computer. So what I add to this guy adds to the outcome of his life, you know, and good lifestyle kind of cures a lot of that, you know.
Well, you know what's so neat? We talked about this before, but like, I'm going to be 65 this year, and I've never been at a better place in my life, never been happier, and went through a lot of stuff thanks to, you know, addictions I had.
Yeah.
And I lost a lot of my life, you know, and a bunch of stuff happened, but here I am, God was in charge, and here I am today, and life has never been better, right?
Yeah, and all those things that are part and parcel of the ingredients that resulted now in your life had to be part of it, or it wouldn't be that way.
Yeah, I wish I could have told people years ago when I was drunk 24/7, God's got a plan, don't worry.
Yeah, and if you try and mess mine up, you're going to have a bloody nose or something.
Yeah, and I'd be getting punched out. I go, okay, that's enough.
I'm just kidding you. Okay, that feeling of, well, here's another way to look at it is about being victimized. Now, we talk of this fellow in the story who, out of fear, actually pushed someone's wife out to be raped, and he knew that would happen, raped and abused and ultimately dead out of fear. And then let's say when that guy comes to grips with what he's really done, you know, and let's assume that instead of putting a woman out there, he had put a man out there. And that being so important in his head would have been even worse probably for his experience. But how does he look at that later when he realizes that he caused this in one way or another? He'll feel that way. I caused this person to die, you know, and she was innocent and did nothing. You know, where does that leave me? Okay, so that's when, you know, taking on the victim role is a positive thing, because that guy's got to say, well, not only the woman I pushed out the door was a victim, I was a victim based on the fear I was experiencing from these hooligans outside, you know. And how does he come to grips with his life that, you know, he needs to be forgiven too, you know, and how does he ask for it? How does he feel right, you know? And I think those are things.
That's terrible.
I mean, just the sense I get, the feeling I get for the... for the guy, I guess it's because, again, because we see so many people who out of fear, in a lot of cases, do things that end up in the loss of life and so on. And we don't have any explanation. We just know they can be perfectly functional beings, you know, when they're not in the midst of some kind of criminal offense or something, you know, or not even that. In our case, 95% of the... now, people are doing whatever they do to get the drugs that that they're addicted to, you know, which they never asked to be addicted to, which they never thought in a million years they would be addicted to. Yet they're blamed in totality for every outcome of what happens as a result of them being that way. And folks, if you remember nothing else about this show, remember that this addiction, anywhere you see it, is a disease. There's changes in the way the brain works. There's changes that now can be documented in terms of, you know, how much of something is going on in a different part of it and so on. And they can find identical features in things such as, you know, alcoholic versus a certain kind of mental illness. And they see the correlation, the things that are coming together, that are together, but are coming together where we can understand them as humans, is coming. Technology has proven it. It's just it's a matter of time. But just accept that before you condemn people.
Oh, yeah. It's an addiction. It's not a choice they're making. You know. Anyway, it's
so sad, really, isn't it? I mean, because, you know, again, not harp on this, but we meet so many people who, man, like, we go into these places and sometimes we'll get 8 or 10, and I think I told a story recently, and Peter and I were in, and we got 14 people from a unit of, you know, intense mental therapy, and
they seem and fine so to on. Me, Scott.
Yeah, Peter almost stayed, but anyway, it was a but it was a great experience, because we went in into a room where there was, in the beginning, so many people and things going seemingly wrong. One obstinate person whose first words to me were "shut up," and you know, and the second word was "shut
know
up."
I didn't know that was an option.
I thought, "Oh, this would really be great," and you know, and we've got two tablefuls, you know, a room for tables around, or chairs around two tables to fit all the people in, and one person decided that sitting between those tables would be the best option, and she just sat there, so we built our little meeting around her being in the middle of the two. But anyway, in the end, again, you know, we let it go, and we, you know, we knew we were powerless, and we sensed that she was too, and so on, and eventually she moved, and she became the greatest participant in the meeting. But the long and the short of it is, by the end of this meeting, these people and Peter and I were all kind of one unit, going the same way, feeling the same way, and everybody's high on something which, you know, nobody put in their mouth, sort of thing. And that's the kind of high, folks, if you can ever get a glimpse or a touch or a taste of that, you'll know why Peter and I go to jail so often to get high. It's not to take part in the odd drug that gets left behind in there, but rather to get high on the people who have no reason whatsoever to come out and meet with us, and we have no reason whatsoever other than love to go and see them, and we're together.
To have the people thank us for coming at the end is just, whoa.
Yeah, even pray. And
yes, you know, yes. Yeah.
And that's amazing, folks. If you know, if you're a prayerful person or been brought up that way, it's no big deal. But for those of us who weren't, learning to you know, to talk to an entity you can't see, and these kinds of things are quite nerve-wracking for a lot of people still. And these people doing this, never having done it before, in some cases, you know, you can tell. Yet they're reaching out to their sense of spirituality, to their sense of a God or a power out there, on behalf of us. You know, and asking that entity, whatever they believe in, to take care of us, you know, when we're going out of the jail and they're staying in where something can happen any moment.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it's beautiful. And, you know, when I try and get people to take on this responsibility, very few jump at it. But everybody who does and sticks it out a bit realizes what a powerful place to be when you're, you know, you're loved before you even get there, and then you're able to take this pure love from the people that society thinks are the worst people on earth, and not only give it back to them, but to take it outside and share it with people you know. And they don't know where it's coming and where it emanates, but we know where it comes from, and we know we're loving you better because all the people you threw in jail for diseases are loving us that way first. And it's pretty powerful.
Yes.
Pretty powerful. So when you think of abuse, and I know you had a good upbringing and so on, Pete, so feeling abused in that sense, and yet you rebelled with the long hair and so on, which never seems to get a trim, but you know, it's just
not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, absolutely. And you know, I mean, wings are powerful, you know, so. But you did rebel, and I'm wondering, in a sense, what it was you rebelled against, you know, where life was so good. I mean, you tell me all the things you do, and I'm jealous, to be honest, because I don't know what that's like. I didn't have that, you know. And
life was good, but there were just these rules. Don't do this, don't do that. And they didn't make any sense. And culture was changing, and I was just a rebel without a clue, and I still am.
But when you look back, were there, you know, usually it comes in bunches, guys like you, but you were alone pretty much in that, weren't you?
Yeah.
In the hair, at least.
But you know what? Life turned out great.
Yeah.
You know, the parents who I rebelled against, I got to be with them in their last years, looking after them.
Yeah.
The best thing ever.
Yeah, another thing, right? A gift that so many won't experience out of false fears and things, but to take a person to the end is very, very powerful. But for me, anyway, you know. And then for those of you out there who are afraid to do that, do it anyway. You know, go there and do it. And no matter how much you fear, it's not you. And if you're the one handing the person over to something higher that you believe in, there's so much power in that. So. Something to think about. What else here? Oh, before I forget, the Hummingbird Hub, a great little organization next door to here, 6331 Main Street here in Stouffville. Cusack, Laura Cusack is the name of the lady who runs that. And she is able to, like magic, put together collaborative resources and to dig into the resource that'll make the most difference in a life or in something that's going on at any given time. And she's a great person. And we usually stop in after the show, and I'm sure some of us, if not three of us, will drop in for a little while just to be there in case somebody comes along and wants to, dig out what we do in this operation, or even share a little something or nothing, or just listen and have a coffee or even a bowl of soup, I understand, if they mention that they want one. Don't mention my name, but
yeah, Laura's amazing. And actually, just this week we became Facebook friends. I guess she didn't recognize me when she accepted my request.
Oh yeah. You were on Facebook before the hair group.
I don't know.
Peter's hair, though, you get to love it, folks.
Memory loss.
But I actually should tell you the story of when we went to jail.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Peter and I, and there was about eight women in there, and they were brought to us for a meeting, and we're all sitting around this table, and somehow Peter had put on a shirt that was the exact color of green that these women in that institution wore. And Peter's hair is long, I mean, halfway down his back, and he sat with his back to the door. Now... The one thing that's key to the control in all these institutions is that numbers in and numbers out and so on, all these things have to be equal. So here, you know, a guard does a count, brings number 7 in or 8, whatever it was. And then he comes back minutes later and does a count. It seems like there's one too many. You know, and that's one less, you know, that happens and they all go nuts. But one extra, what the heck do we do about this? And there's another guard coming over. Anyway, long story short, in the end, as we left, the guard realized it was a man with long hair and a green shirt. You know, more or less said to Peter, please don't do that again. but these are the things, and we laugh like crazy in there too, you know, and even in the midst of this, and people, some of them are going forever. I mean, we've met a couple now who are, you know, the rest of their time is going to be in institutions very likely, and if not, somebody has died as a result of something they were involved with, and they've got to live with that, whether they get out of jail or not. And a couple things here, when we're talking about collaboration, especially in mentor-mentee's experience there with Elizabeth Trombley, that CEO, you know, who's trying to bring together any organizations that can really help the homeless, the incarcerated, the addicted, the mentally ill. in all of this comes together, and we're being invited in as integral in the sense that because we deal with the same people, but we deal with them in an institution and often outside of an institution, whether it be bringing them on this show here to share experiences or whether it be just hooking up somehow later on outside, maybe at a meeting or whatever. But anyway, power, power, power. And the way these ladies can seem to bring these things together just blows me away. But, you know, that being the case, back to this powerless and abused, you know, what have we sacrificed for our selfishness, you know? What looked like selfishness was the ultimate, might have been the epitome, might have been this guy, you know, throwing a woman out to be basically abused and killed, maybe out of fear totally. But like we said before, he's got to live with that after. And I mean, unless the guy's an absolute nut bar, he's going to feel horrible and not going to be able to explain this to himself in any way, shape, or form. Yet that guy to be any sort of regular person producing properly and in a loving way has to be forgiven, you know. And where is that guy going to get forgiven? Because most people out there won't. They kill that guy and make his life horrible. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of the attitude. So anyway, my point here is rational thinking, you know, which is always... One camp is rational, the other one's emotional, you know, no matter what you're talking about, whether it's politics, whether it's, you know, in a hospital, in a jail, or wherever, you have the rational thinker and you have the emotional unthinker, the emotional fool that I am, by the way, on and off, so I'm not pointing at this at anybody else. But one of the things we've tried to come up with here that we push out there a lot is what I call, anyway, emotional sobriety. You can even take that into spiritual sobriety and a lot of other things. But, you know, EQ, emotional quotient, such as an intelligence quotient, so rather than IQ. EQ is probably more important because if we're not living an even-keeled kind of life, in other words, the line we draw across the screen, if it's not fairly level, then our emotions are involved. And when our emotions are involved, we lose the purity of who we are. So everything we do, whether it's reactive or, you know, even response in that sense, everything is tainted to some degree to however much the up and down thing is going on in our life, the feelings, basically. If the feelings aren't somewhat even, our thinking is going to be, you know, less and less rational, you know, in a proportion to the amount we're not emotionally sober. So what do we do with that? You know, how does somebody attain to emotional sobriety? And if they don't, how can they possibly attain to any other kind of sobriety, whether it's booze, drugs, rock and roll, or a compulsion, something bothering you? Like if you don't find that evenness where you can really think properly about it and express it properly, what it is to you, and give that, you know, whether it's to professionals, to other people, it's a big job. So the rational thinker is not just a little deal, you know, it's come up with this way to be emotionally intelligent and then, you know, work on yourself and whatever other specific things you want to get rid of over time. So I don't know how you do all that stuff, but I know it's true, you know. I just know that if people are just emotional before you even finish a sentence, they've got the answer on it. That's not the person to use for any decisions that you have to make, you know. And even if that person's expressing your foolishness or my foolishness, whatever, it doesn't matter. That person is acting out of emotion rather than who he or she really is. So I don't know. What's our part? What do we do? You're dead air, folks. That's what this is.
powerless and abused. I got beat up a couple of times when I was drinking, and.
But why were you powerless?
Sorry. I just mean, like when I was drunk all the time, emotionally, I was whacked, right? Yeah. So. I'd say and do stuff I shouldn't have, and sometimes I'd wake up the next morning with the result. But yeah, if you get rid of your addictions, your whole life changes. Your how you think and how you act. That anyway, I'm not preaching. I'm just saying what happened to me.
Yeah. Well, if we could make this powerlessness available or acceptable to people as a tool for calm, for peace, and so on. Just because everything is sort of predestined, and our part really is to just do our best and with every part of our life. And, you know, and if someone says, well, I'm not going to do that, well, say, oh, well, maybe you're not supposed to. I don't know. But, you know, whatever you do, whatever you do is part of the perfect plan. So, like, don't tell me what you know. It doesn't matter. You know, but it doesn't matter what I said. I'm supposed to say that, too. So if you're supposed to hit me, but I don't think you are, but, you know, then go for it. Anyway. So emotions are a big, big problem out there today, and I hear it. I hear it politically a lot, and I hear when people's back jumps up, and it really jumps up, you know when it's emotional or not. But when someone's back really jumps up, you sort of know if you've had any of this rationality stuff over here that they're really not expressing from the entity, from who they are. They're expressing from who they are plus whatever kind of emotions are going on. So. You know, you can almost, you know, and don't mix up passion and, you know, passion and what's the other one? Don't mix that up anyway with the sobriety of your feelings, your emotions. So you can be passionate, I believe, without being super emotional, or maybe somehow passion is an acceptable part of emotion. I don't know. Because I think passion is, well, it's innate anyway, but I think you want to feel excited about your passion because you want other people to see how important this is to you, even though you can't make it or plan it or anything else. I don't know, man. How do you, you know, what's a victim? Is everybody a victim when they're not emotionally sober? I don't know.
I don't know.
What's the repair? You know, this is really a question. You know, how is a victim victimized? Well, we kind of went through that. Is he emotional like by himself, you know? And either way, like, what do you do? How do you get out of it? And I think, you know, and I'm thinking again of this guy who always sudden comes to grips with what he did. He pushed a woman out. She was brutally murdered and lying on his doorstep, dead and raped and beat up and everything else. And he finally comes to grips with, well, you know, I caused that. How am I going to live with myself? You know, that's when I think the accepting of the responsibility and then just the crying out to your sense of God, of the Almighty, and, you know, and asking for help, for forgiveness and so on. And just to be that freeing experience that allows the person to live, because that person wouldn't be alive if he or she wasn't supposed to be. So, and if he or she is, well, that's there for them too. Just like these serial killers and everything else, you know, there can be good moments because you did something horrible, because that was part of your, you know, your design, your purpose. Well, you did it, and yeah, and from a humanoid perspective, you accept responsibility, but you need to ask something greater for some forgiveness, I believe. And that's when, for me, and I can't bring too many circumstances like that to mind, but I can almost feel for this whole thing that's going on when I read it this morning, and I'm thinking, man, that's when, you know, you really have to cry out and ask something greater to help you out, because it's just no answer from the humanoids that I can think of. Anyway, Jay, what do you got for us this morning? What about a little mention of what's going on with Block Party and... where you're going, maybe in some of your ventures to help others with the kidney situations. What's happening in your life?
Well, Scott, I think we got to take another break. We only took the one break, so
why don't
we take another break? I'll come back and we'll talk about the Block Party.
You can do that.
All right.
Please.
You're listening to Sharing the Burden here on Whistle FM.